Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso, recording at our Hideaway studio in East County. Today we open our show with some news about three of the latest Donald Trump appointments for Health and Human Services, Housing and Urban Development, and Education Secretaries. Then from Public News Service, we'll have some national news headlines, including how Donald Trump is reacting to accusations that Russians hacked the election, a warning for parents about toys, and more. On Green Scene, we'll tell you about a brand new trail that's just opened in Ramona. Learn about a new affordable housing bill introduced in Sacramento. And on Crime Beat, hear about the arrest of a man for the murder of an Alpine baby. We'll have some holiday safety tips for you to keep in mind as you decorate for the holidays. From the Sheriff's Department, some good news about saving people who have suffered opioid overdoses. Our newsmaker interview today is with Dilquaz Ahmed, with License to Freedom. She's been working tirelessly to help over 1,000 Syrian refugees who've been brought to El Cajon, and they're in desperate need of help. She's hoping for families in the community to come forward and brighten their holiday season, and for a trip from Santa Claus. Then we'll have a couple of classic holiday special broadcasts for you. David Dickens will be talking about his famous ancestor, Charles Dickens, author of A Christmas Carol. And on Sounds of History, Helen Oldfield will recall some childhood memories. Hear about a Toys for Tots drive right here in East County and how you can help brighten the holiday season for children in need. We'll have all those stories and more on today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital.
Congressman Tom Price, a Republican from Georgia and a medical doctor, is President-elect Donald Trump's nominee to serve as Health and Human Services Secretary. But far from protecting the nation's social safety nets, Price has pledged to slash or dismantle them. Price has called for deep cuts in Medicare and Medicaid, as well as eliminating the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. A bill that he introduced last year sought to eliminate Medicaid coverage from 14 million Americans by halting federal funds for Medicaid expansion in most states, also cutting federal subsidies for people on state health exchanges. A former medical director at a hospital orthopedic clinic in Atlanta, Price has been an outspoken critic of the Obama administration's health care law, which he says attempts to commandeer clinical decision-making by doctors. Unlike some critics of Obamacare, Price does have a plan for replacing it. It's called the Empowering Patients First Act, which would offer age-adjusted tax credits for people to buy their own health insurance policies. It would also establish incentives to pay into health savings accounts. Let insurance companies sell policies across state lines, providing states with grants for limited subsidies to high-risk populations, and let businesses offer coverage through association health plans. But critics say his plan would benefit mainly young, healthy Americans and put older, sicker, and poorer Americans at risk, leaving many with no insurance coverage at all. The plan also relies on consumers voluntarily paying into special accounts to provide care in their old age, ignoring the fact that those with other pressing financial needs or emergencies may be unable to keep up such payments. Price says he wants to eliminate Obamacare because although it provided affordable health care to tens of millions of poor people who had no coverage before, it also raised premiums for many middle-income Americans. He also faulted Obama for promising that people could keep their health care plan if they wished, though some lost their existing coverage when insurers pulled out of states with exchanges. Yet a Kaiser Family Foundation survey shows that despite problems with the Affordable Care Act, 75% of Americans polled said they wanted to keep the law, not repeal it. Over half said they want the law expanded or kept the same, while just 25% want it repealed. Among Trump supporters, 50% want it repealed. Yet paradoxically, even most Trump supporters support key provisions of Obamacare, except for mandates forcing everyone to have insurance. Over 80% of those polled want to keep preventive care such as cancer screenings. They also want to keep a provision allowing young people to stay on parents' health care plans until age 26. Moreover, 8 in 10 Americans want to keep federal subsidies to help low and moderate income people buy health insurance, and a strong majority wants to keep insurance marketplaces set up by Obamacare to let people buy insurance through exchanges if they don't have a health care plan through an employer. But Price's proposal would repeal the best of Obamacare along with the problematic portions, leaving many people with no coverage at all, or only costly options. Insurance companies would no longer be required to cover maternity care for expectant mothers or even prescription drug costs. Coverage for birth control, treatment for drug or alcohol addiction, and certain other medical expenses would also no longer be required, the New York Times reports. A key provision of Obamacare was prohibiting insurance companies from denying coverage to people with pre-existing conditions. Price would get rid of that protection unless you've already had continuous insurance coverage for 18 months. If you had a gap due to illness, job loss, travel, or other reasons, you won't be guaranteed coverage. Price would also make it harder to sue a doctor for malpractice. In addition, doctors could just opt out of covering Medicare patients and charge people more than is allowed under the Medicare program that currently covers millions of elderly Americans. Price has also drawn controversy for his votes to restrict abortion, which earned him a 100% score in Congress with the National Right to Life Committee and a zero from Planned Parenthood. He has also been an outspoken opponent of gay rights, leading some gay rights activists to voice concerns about him overseeing health care for all Americans. The American Hospital Association has urged that Obamacare not be repealed without a backup plan in place. The American Medical Association initially issued a statement supportive of Price for backing patient choice and reducing excessive regulatory burdens, but later backed off its stance after the Clinician Action Network wrote an open letter to the association saying Price's policies threaten to harm our most vulnerable patients and limit their access to care, U.S. News reports. Senate Democrats are vowing to fight Price's nomination. New York Senator Chuck Schumer, who will be the minority leader starting in January, concludes, "When it comes to issues like Medicare, the Affordable Care Act, and Planned Parenthood, Congressman Price and the average American couldn't be further apart. Between this nomination of an avowed Medicare opponent to serve as HHS Secretary and Republicans here in Washington threatening to privatize Medicare, it's clear that Republicans are plotting a war on seniors next year." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Gene Carpenter.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ. Continuing his string of maverick cabinet appointments, President-elect Donald Trump has announced he will appoint retired neurosurgeon Ben Carson, also a former presidential candidate, to serve as Director of Housing and Urban Development. The appointment has drawn criticism due to Carson's lack of experience and his statements opposing affirmative action. But others have voiced cautious optimism that the doctor, who was raised in poverty in Detroit, could bring a physician's expertise and compassion to issues such as improving public health by cleaning up public housing. Carson would be heading up an agency with a $48 billion budget, but he has no experience in housing issues nor in any government work. Contrary to some fake news reports, he also never lived in public housing, although he did grow up in a poor family in urban Detroit. Carson later said poverty is a choice that he chose to escape from, rising to become a neurosurgeon who gained fame for his success in separating conjoined twins. He has openly criticized HUD's fair housing rule, requiring local communities to examine patterns of discrimination in housing, calling that rule a mandated social engineering scheme that he likened to government infiltration of private lives seen in communist countries. In an editorial last year, Carson wrote, "These government-engineered attempts to legislate racial equality create consequences that often make matters worse." Critics have noted that Donald Trump and his father both have a history of racial discrimination in housing that they owned. In 1973, President Nixon's Justice Department sued Donald Trump and his father, Fred Trump, for discriminating against African Americans in New York. The case settled in 1975 with a consent decree that the Trumps were later accused of breaking. New York Councilman Jumaine Williams chairs the city's Housing and Buildings Committee. He says Carson's appointment is ill-advised, irresponsible, and hovers on absurdity. The councilman fears funds for Section 8 vouchers could be cut, and moreover, in an interview on Democracy Now!, he stated, "You have a president who believes in discrimination, I think particularly when it comes to housing. He has an experience doing that." He suggests that Trump's appointment of Carson, an African-American man who does not believe in the Fair Housing Act or recent actions by the Obama administration to strengthen fair housing protections, could lead to a dismantling of those provisions. But South Carolina Senator Tim Scott, who is also African-American, thinks Carson could bring a fresh perspective, and that as someone who actually lived in poverty, he could help others to escape it. Scott says funds for inspecting public housing have languished for years unused. He wants to see more inspections done, and also hopes Carson will work to create a path to transition people out of subsidized housing and into the free market. Some public health officials hope that Carson will apply his medical knowledge for the public good. Mariana Arcaya, an assistant professor of urban planning at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, or MIT, observes, "Not having access to safe, affordable housing is one of the least healthy situations you can find yourself in." Studies have shown that unstable housing conditions are related to health problems ranging from depression to drug use to lead poisoning in children. HUD actions that have positively impacted public health include banning smoking in public housing and setting acceptable blood levels for lead in children who live in federally subsidized homes. Where housing is located can also affect residents' access to fresh foods, medical services, parks, and the ability to get exercise and fresh air. Dr. Georges Benjamin, executive director of the American Public Health Association, says he has no idea how Dr. Carson's medical training will influence his actions at HUD if Carson is approved by the Senate, but he notes that neurosurgeons do work as teams and must make detailed plans. Dr. Benjamin has offered up one healthy suggestion for Carson, if he is confirmed. He hopes to see HUD release an annual report on the health of people living in public housing so that successes in improving the health of public housing residents can be assessed each year.
This is Gene Carpenter with East County Magazine's Education Report. President-elect Donald Trump has nominated Betsy DeVos to serve as Secretary of Education. But the nomination has drawn sharp criticism from prominent educators due to her support for directing public funds into private and largely religious schools. Trump called DeVos a brilliant and passionate education advocate who he says will reform the bureaucracy that is holding our children back so that we can deliver world-class education and school choice to all families. But National Education Association President Eskelson Garcia released a media statement indicating that past reforms by DeVos have done more to undermine public education than support students. Garcia says DeVos has lobbied for, quote, failed schemes like vouchers, which take away funding and local control from our public schools to fund private schools at taxpayers' expense, unquote. DeVos has no training or experience in public education. She has never served as a teacher and has not had children educated in public schools. She also opposes Common Core standards established by the federal government during the Obama administration. She is a billionaire whose family donated substantially to the Trump campaign. Her brother is Eric Prince, founder of Blackwater, the private military contractor. Her husband is Dick DeVos, Jr., heir to the Amway fortune and funder of various conservative causes from pro-life legislation to so-called cure therapy for gay people. Betsy DeVos has said that the Education Freedom Fund founded by her husband and herself is Christian in its nature because in excess of 90% of the parents who receive these scholarships choose Christian schools to go to. A believer in creationism, she has stated that God led us to reform public education, PR Watch reports. And according to Politico, she has likened her education reform efforts to a battleground for God's kingdom. DeVos was one of the architects of the Detroit charter school system, but Douglas Harris, professor of economics at Tulane University, wrote in a New York Times editorial that the system designed by DeVos had no oversight and has been acknowledged even by charter advocates as the biggest school reform disaster in the nation. Detroit had the lowest reading and mathematics scores by far of any city participating in the National Assessment of Educational Progress. Yet even poorly performing schools were allowed to keep enrolling students. Citizens Oversight founder Ray Lutz in El Cajon says that the school privatization has been clearly shown not to be any better than public schools and that market-based approaches do not solve education problems. If DeVos is approved by the Senate as education secretary, Lutz predicts, say goodbye to good local public schools and hello to education rationing.
Welcome to the Public News Service Daily Newscast for Monday, December 12th, 2016. I'm Mary Sherman. Today's rundown features a variety of stories, including intelligence leaders are troubled as Trump rejects a Russian hacking report, researchers warn of dire consequences should the Affordable Care Act be repealed, and parents are urged to stay away from toys that spy on kids. Leading our news, U.S. intelligence officials on Sunday expressed concern about President-elect Donald Trump's dismissal of CIA findings that Russia tried to sway the presidential election. Trump called the conclusion that Russia worked to help him win the election a ridiculous idea. A U.S. intelligence official told NBC News that it's troubling Trump is disputing professional intelligence judgments as false or politically partisan. Meanwhile, Trump is expected to soon announce more cabinet picks, including former Texas Governor Rick Perry, who is said to be the top choice for energy secretary. Perry once said he would abolish the Department of Energy if elected president and then forgot it was one of the agencies he wanted to kill. Washington State Congresswoman Kathy McMorris Rodgers is expected to be Trump's pick for Secretary of the Interior. The appointment would put her in charge of the department that manages federal public lands and natural resources, and that has some Northwest conservation groups worried. The League of Conservation Voters gives McMorris Rodgers a score of 4% for her environmental record in Congress. Defenders of Wildlife gives her a zero. Sam Mace is with the group Save Our Wild Salmon.
It's disappointing to see an appointment of a politician who has carried the water for hydropower interests at the expense of healthy rivers and wild salmon and the jobs that depend on those resources.
Mace's concern, McMorris Rodgers' support of four lower Snake River dams in particular, is hurting endangered salmon. Financial experts, meanwhile, are warning against knee-jerk reactions to President-elect Trump's tweets. Veronica Carter has the story.
Since election night, when it was announced Trump had won, there have been some dramatic swings in the stock market. Paul Nolte of Kingsview Asset Management says people who invest in a company or an industry should do serious research before buying or selling off in reaction to something on social media. He says usually the financial world isn't affected by one person's opinion.
We don't see it as much in the financial industry, so this is kind of new for us, but then again, we're all learning how to live with a tweet president who is not afraid about getting out on social media and giving the world his opinion.
Nolte says 140 character bursts of opinion on Twitter are just that, one person's abbreviated views, and not enough information for making a big financial decision.
Politicians on both sides of the aisle would admit there is room for improvement for the Affordable Care Act and the health exchange, but a growing number of Republicans are calling for repeal of the legislation. As Stephanie Carson reports, repealing the ACA without a replacement, though, could be costly.
While starting over sounds logical to some, a new report from the Urban Institute finds that would come at a significant cost to millions of Americans. Rob Thompson with NC Child says eliminating coverage for the million in North Carolina that would be impacted could be catastrophic.
If a million people in our state lose health insurance coverage, it's going to have a dramatic impact on their financial security as parents, as individuals, as families, because we know that health care costs can be extremely burdensome for families.
According to the report, the number of uninsured people would more than double to 59 million by 2019. Additionally, 82% of the uninsured would be working families.
Newtown plans to mark the fourth anniversary of the Sandy Hook school massacre with 15 minutes of reflective silence on Wednesday. The town also will lower its flags to half staff to honor the 20 children and six educators shot to death when a gunman entered the Sandy Hook Elementary School on December 14, 2012. The gunman, who had earlier killed his mother inside their home, also took his own life. In wildlife news, as grizzlies look set for removal from the endangered species list, some researchers are concerned the model used for predicting the bear's population won't hold up if hunting starts. Eric Tagedoff has more.
The grizzly population in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem is thought to be around 700. States rely on the Interagency Grizzly Bear Committee and its estimator, called CHOW-2. However, Professor Lynn Broberg at the University of Montana used a modeler called Ramis, and he says this modeler predicts a sharper decline than CHOW-2 if hunting of grizzlies is allowed.
Even if things stay basically as they have been for the past decade, my model indicates that the rate of harvest they're projecting may cause some serious problems for grizzly bear population size.
Broberg says the committee's model underestimates the number of males that would be killed by hunters. Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks denies this is the case. The U.S. Geological Survey says at least 55 grizzlies were killed this year, an unusually high mortality rate for the bears.
With less than 2 weeks before Christmas Day, a new report from a consumer watchdog group has some tips for holiday shoppers who want to avoid toys that collect internet data on kids and more.
Josh Golan with the Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood says its 2016 report shines a spotlight on toys that, in effect, spy on very young children on the web.
Whether it's trying to connect toys to the internet so that the toys are collecting data from children, or whether it's marketing violence to children or precocious sexuality.
Consumer groups last week filed a lawsuit with the Federal Trade Commission alleging that some toys now on the market are threatening a child's privacy and security. I'm Greg Stottlemyre reporting.
And I'm Mary Sherman for Public News Service, member and listener supported, and online at publicnewsservice.org.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is John Fisteer with a Green Scene Report. A dedication ceremony was held in Ramona last week for a new public trail along San Vicente Road. A 2-mile section of San Vicente from Warnock Drive through Wildcat Canyon to the entrance of San Diego Country Estates has been widened and straightened, also adding a 10-foot-wide multi-use trail alongside the roadway. It's all part of a decades-long effort by the community to improve safety on San Vicente, where many serious traffic accidents, including several fatality crashes, have occurred. The roadway is one of the major access routes to Barona Resort and Casino, as well as a back route from Ramona to downtown Lakeside. The $22 million project was completed 2 months ago, and so far not a single serious accident has occurred, according to the county. The effort was spearheaded by Ramona resident Joe Kahak and Supervisor Diane Jacob. The new trail will accommodate pedestrians, equestrians, and bicyclists. The Ramona Sentinel reports that Supervisor Jacob said of the project, "This is another big part of the county's efforts to preserve open space and then put the trails in so people of all ages can have the experience of enjoying nature by getting out and exercising, whether on horseback or hiking."
This is East County Magazine's Crime Beat. On the streets, reporting on crimes impacting communities across our region, helping to keep you safe and informed.
This is Miriam Raftery with an East County Crime Beat report. Detectives with the Sheriff's Homicide Detail and Fugitive Task Force have arrested Alpine resident Wiley Foster in connection with the death of 18-month-old Leah Brown Meza. Foster is the live-in boyfriend of the baby's mother. Foster was taken into custody at their home on Hunter Lane. He will be booked into the San Diego County Jail on a single count of murder, according to Lieutenant Kenneth Nelson. The medical examiner's office has ruled the death a homicide. Cause of death was multiple blunt force trauma. Anyone with information about this crime is asked to call the homicide detail at 858-974-2321, or you can remain anonymous by calling Crime Stoppers at 888-580-8477.
State Senator Tony Atkins started off the first day of the new legislative session by introducing Senate Bill 2, legislation to create a permanent source of funding for affordable housing. The San Diego Democrat says the legislature must address California's severe housing crisis. While local communities largely control housing development, there are ways the state can help. Considering how hard it has become for an increasing number of Californians to afford housing, we need to step up, she adds. Home ownership has become an impossible dream for many Californians, with even rental prices skyrocketing out of reach. That lack of affordability is also contributing to the rise in homelessness in our state and in the San Diego County region. A census report showed that in 2014, California renters were spending over 36% of their income on housing, and our state had the nation's second lowest rate of home ownership. The Apartment List recently released a survey of more than 30,000 renters. Most millennial renters, those under 35, no longer view home ownership, long an American dream, as attainable. Among those surveyed in San Diego, 89% see home ownership as unrealistic. That's worse than the rates in San Francisco or Los Angeles. Senate Bill 2 is similar to legislation which then Assembly Speaker Atkins introduced last year. It seeks to fund construction of affordable homes on an ongoing basis through a modest recording fee on certain types of real estate transactions, but not home sales. The new bill adds two allowable uses for the funding: local community plan updates and fiscal incentives for local governments to approve new housing for low-income families. Providing funding for planning updates aims to be sure that new development reflects current community desires. Providing funding for low-income housing incentives aspires to help create more diverse neighborhoods, a proven way to battle socially harmful economic segregation, says Atkins. She concludes, no matter what steps are taken to increase the market-rate housing stock, there will always be a need for homes that are attainable to those among us with the lowest incomes. The bill will help hundreds, if not thousands, of families each year. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ Radio, the network for social justice, this is Rebecca Williamson.
The lights are likely up outside, so now is a good time to look at some safety tips for inside the home as the holiday season nears. Fire Chief and East County Magazine columnist Sam DiGiovanna says, when purchasing an artificial tree, look for the label fire resistant. When purchasing a live tree, check for freshness. Never use tree preservatives, which can be toxic for pets that drink the water. When setting up a tree at home, place it away from fireplaces and radiators. Heated rooms dry live trees out rapidly. Be sure to keep the stand filled with water. Do not block doorways. Use only lights that have been tested for safety by a recognized testing laboratory. Check each set of lights, new or old, for broken or cracked sockets, frayed or bare wires, or loose connections, and throw out damaged sets. Always replace burned-out bulbs promptly with the same wattage bulbs. Use no more than 3 standard-sized sets of lights per single extension cord. Never use electronic lights on a metallic tree. The tree can become charged with electricity from faulty lights, and a person touching a branch could be electrocuted. Turn off all lights when you go to bed or leave the house. The lights could short out and start a fire. Never use lighted candles on a tree or near other evergreens. In homes with small children, take special care to avoid sharp, weighted, or breakable decorations. Keep trimmings with small, removable parts out of the reach of children who could swallow or inhale small pieces. And avoid trimmings that resemble candy or food that may tempt a child to eat them. Do not burn wrapping papers in the fireplace. For additional holiday safety information, contact your local fire department. Merry Christmas and be safe.
The County of San Diego reports an experimental program that allows sheriff's deputies to administer antidotes to people suffering from opioid overdoses is saving lives. Since 2014, the county indicates that 37 people have been saved due to deputies providing the life-saving drug to people overdosing on opioids, such as heroin, morphine, or oxycodone. The Sheriff's Department is the only law enforcement agency in the county that carries the antidote, but other local police are considering carrying it in the near future, says Captain Todd Richardson. Last year, 90 people died of heroin overdoses, and in 2014, heroin killed 105 people locally, according to the Medical Examiner's Office. A person overdosing on opioids will stop breathing without intervention. They become pale and cold, their lips or nails may turn blue, and they may be unable to speak or awaken. If these symptoms occur, they need immediate medical attention. A quick dose of an opioid inhibitor such as naloxone immediately allows the person to breathe on their own. Every year, sheriff's deputies are the first to arrive on the scene, ahead of paramedics or firefighters, in approximately 150 overdose cases. In July of 2014, the San Diego County Sheriff's Department began a six-month pilot program to train deputies from an East County station to carry and administer the life-saving nasal spray drug. 14 of the 15 people who received the antidote survived. The program's high success rate resulted in the Sheriff's Department expanding the program. In nearly 2 years since, it has been used another 29 times, saving 23 patients. The drug is currently carried by all sheriff's patrol units, plus units at courts and schools. For deputies to have a chance at saving a life, someone has to call 911 to report the medical emergency, and they need to begin CPR if the person has stopped breathing. But often, a person with the patient who is overdosing may also be under the influence of drugs and afraid to call for help for fear of being arrested. But a Good Samaritan law passed in 2012 says that if you're calling for help for an overdose for yourself or anyone else, you can't be arrested for being under the influence of an illegal narcotic or possessing the narcotic. There are exceptions. If the caller is selling narcotics, administered the drug without the person's consent, was driving under the influence, or violated their probation or parole. The county funds drug prevention and treatment services throughout the region. Treatment is available by calling the county's Access and Crisis Line at 888-724-7240. One more time, that's the county's Access and Crisis Line at 888-724-7240. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Lynn Powell Macklin.
The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice in Descanso, recording at our Hideaway studio in East County. My very special guest today is Dilkhwaz Ahmed. She is the Executive Director of License to Freedom, which is a nonprofit organization in El Cajon. Dilkhwaz, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Marian. Thanks a lot for having me today.
You're welcome. Now, can you start by telling our listeners what the mission is of License to Freedom?
The mission of License to Freedom is to promote nonviolence through community education, self-sufficiency, and advocacy for refugee and immigrants, survivors of domestic violence and sexual abuse.
So you work primarily with refugees and immigrants who've been through these, you know, horrific ordeals, domestic violence or abuse of some sort. But recently you've become involved in working with the newest refugees, the Syrian refugees who come from such a horrific war-torn situation over there.
Right.
So tell us, how many Syrian refugees do we have now here in East County?
We don't have the exact number, but what I know that every day I register about 50 to 60 members every day.
Every single day.
Every single day. So if I can say 2,000, if I say 1,000, but we have a lot. And they still come in. They still come in every day, every day.
Wow. And that's just the Syrians, over 1,000.
Just Syrians,
yes. My goodness. What kind of help are they getting? We've written a couple of articles about this. I know that you did a wonderful Thanksgiving dinner to welcome some of the newcomers here. But it also sounds like that there's just not enough
help. A lot of them sounded like they were very worried, living in hotels at $100-something a day with not an easy ability to find housing since a lot of them have larger families. What do you do to help them when they arrive?
Well, when they arrive, we try to meet them with their immediate necessities. They don't have enough food. They don't have food stamps. They don't have clothes. You know, they came from different culture, different lifestyle. So we try to help them with assimilation and help them with the acculturation, what work, what doesn't work, how to navigate the system, what's that mean to be in a new country. We try to address issues of family violence and support them how to use the healthy communication, listening to each other. Especially, you know, we have a family of 9 people living in 1-bedroom motel.
Oh, that's going to be terribly stressful.
Dark with 2 beds. It's so difficult. They don't have kitchen to cook. They don't have material. So we try to support them, get them at least a small electric stove, electric pot, electric teapot, some clothes, some shampoo. And we have doctor in our organization. This doctor is provided by a public consulting group to work with our organization. So we provide them with some health literacy, especially the most of them, they brought some medication with them, so they don't know how to use it here. So the doctor are helping them. He read it and he go through it, try to support them.
Yeah. What kind of actual aid do they get from the federal government, or for that matter, is there anything from the state when they first arrive? What sort of help, if any, is there for them?
There is not that much help. They have to wait for 2 weeks to get their food stamp. So pretty much for 2 weeks, they don't have anything. Later on, family of 8 or 9, they are getting $1,300 cash, about $800 food stamp. So the problem is for a family of 9, they have to rent an apartment with 3 bedrooms. Apartment with 3 bedrooms, it's about $1,600 to $1,650. And they so concerned. They, you know, in Syria for a long time, they don't have any birth control or anything.
Yeah.
So the family, when they arrive, they are 9, family of 11. They don't have money. And in East County, rent is just going up every day.
Yeah. So it's really not even enough to cover rent and necessities by the time you add in utilities. And
it's
so
not enough at all.
How long are they able to get that aid?
As long as they have kids under the age of 18.
All right. Are there English language classes for them, job training? What kind of help are they able to receive, and what more is needed to help them become self-sufficient, which obviously I'm sure would be the goal of everyone?
Before everything, they have to learn language. Syria is the only country they don't speak English, you know? Like you see, we have a lot of refugees coming from Iraq, from Afghanistan. They have some limited English. But for Syrian, the study, everything is in Arabic.
Oh.
Some of them speak some French, but not English. So first, we have to focus how to get them go to ESL class. Our organization offer many ESL class, acculturation, health literacy. We offer a lot of services, including how to navigate the system. So we try to involve them in our program and support them in a different way.
Very good. What would you say to the people out there who are concerned about these refugees coming in? We've heard Donald Trump, who says he doesn't want to admit any more Syrian refugees. He's concerned, I guess, about terrorism. There's also some who've raised concerns about just the fact that the community has already absorbed a lot of refugees and resources are strained. But I know these people have been through horrific ordeals. What would your response be to those who have raised those concerns?
Well, I would just say, come and listen to those people. I would say come sit with them and listen to their stories. They are one of the kindest. They are one of the most peaceful. They are here just to live. And they are thankful. They are thankful for every single American who opened their heart before their arm to them. They are not terrorists. We can't just judge them just because they are from Syria. And I think the stories you publish on East County Magazine, those people say, ISIS are not Syrian. We've been victims of ISIS.
Right. They're fleeing the terrorists.
They are. And they've been hurt a lot by ISIS.
Yeah.
If you go, you know, meet with their kids, they just play and they just fly as a butterfly. They're so happy just to be here, even in this small, you know, motel room. But they are so thankful to be safe. The people tell me all the time, at least we can walk, we can run, nobody bomb us and nobody kill us.
Yeah, I read that in Syria, 80% of the children are at risk. And of course, a lot of them have already been killed or they've been traumatized, witnessing horrible things. I know our reporter Rachel was down there and she interviewed one family where the little girl had actually seen ISIS, I guess, beheading people. It has to be so traumatic for the children. Is there psychological counseling available to
very
help
limited
deal with that?
Limited. Like I can say, very limited services for them. We were not expecting that amount of Syrian to arrive. Mm-hmm. We're so happy to have them. We're so happy to be able to help, but the needs are huge. It takes a village.
So what can people do if they're listening right now and they want to get involved and help in some way? Tell us what your organization needs. Again, you are Licensed to Freedom. And it looks like your website is
www.licensetofreedom.org.
Licensetofreedom.org.
You know, through the article, I am so thankful that I got some phone call from some people who want to come
wonderful.
And help. But we need more. We are talking about 200 families. What we need volunteers to come. And you know what? Just show them what real Americans are. Because when I came as a refugee, some American people who came and tapped on my shoulder and they told me, Delquaz, it's going to be okay. And you're going to pass through all of the difficulty. And
yeah.
I am. And
yeah,
I am.
So
we want to show them the love that Americans have. We want to show them the respect for refugees because this country built on refugees. So we want to welcome them and support them so they will be able to support others.
Yes. I've heard you say that your hope would be that every one of these Syrian families could have an American family that would sort of adopt and mentor them and keep an eye on them and help in some way.
Exactly. They have a lot of needs. For example, they don't speak English. They don't understand the system. At least just, you know, they have a small food stamp, but they don't know how to use it.
Mm-hmm.
We try to help them as much as we can, but as I mentioned, I'm the only employee through some volunteers. We're trying to do the best. But if some people can contact me and say, what we can do so I can link them to those Syrian families.
Yeah.
They are so sweet. They're so poor. But when people go visit them, they try to bring the entire kitchen, you know, coffee, chocolate that they bought from their food stamp and give
That's
it
sweet.
To the people who visit them. They're so generous. And I'm sure whoever go visit them, they will love them and they will become so attached to them, so they will never, ever leave them.
Okay. Well, Delquaz, I'm so glad you were able to join us here and help educate our listeners a little bit about what the Syrians are going through and what their needs are. We certainly want to stay in touch with you. Keep us posted on how this develops and what new needs you may see out there and how perhaps some of our listeners, you know, who are compassionate can help. Certainly an argument could be made, I think, that even for those who may have concerns about, you know, the number of refugees and so forth, the best way to prevent somebody from becoming radicalized is to make them feel included and welcomed and part of society. And so that's certainly what we hope for the best for these people now that they're here, that they can be welcomed by Americans.
And they deserve some chance. Let's give them a chance. Let's not judge them. And I just would like to add that we're going to have a Christmas party. The date is not, you know, to be announced yet.
Oh, wonderful.
So we're just going to show them. And I hope that Santa will contact me because those people will be, you know, all of the trauma, all of the pain that they've been through, it will go. It's just a good healing if they see real Santa, you know, coming and handing them some gifts. We are through donation, we're receiving some gifts, but even a toothpaste, if it's coming from Santa, will be really, really, you know, changing the life of those people forever, forever.
Well, that's a wonderful, heartwarming holiday story. We certainly want to thank you for joining us on the show today. And listeners, if you just turned in, we've been speaking with Delquaz Ahmed. She is the executive director of License to Freedom, which is a nonprofit right here in El Cajon that's dedicated to helping refugees and immigrant families, including currently the hundreds of Syrians that have recently arrived in East County. Delquaz, thank you for joining us on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice.
Thank you very much for having me. Thanks a lot.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
Hello, my name is David Dickens, David Charles Dickens to be exact. I want to talk to you today, audience, about the links between me and Charles Dickens and the writers that have become in our family. According to my late grandfather, Charles Elmer Dickens, who died in the summer of 1992, prior to departing, I was told I am related to Charles Dickens, one of our greatest authors of all time, and I am four generations down, so a great, 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 great grandfather, right down the family tree. I'm a current freelancer for East County Magazine, write mostly sports features. However, if something creative comes my way, I'm always happy to take it. Also come from another family member, my father, Bill Dickens, who currently owns eastcountysports.com, has been covering sports locally in East County for over 43 years. I'm going to speak about Charles Dickens today and one of his finest novels, A Christmas Carol, that was written in December of 1843. Not only is this a great selection for the season, but also referring to Dickens' early childhood, humiliating experiences, his sympathy for the poor folks, and great fairy tales he was read as a child. The lesson that should be learned from this particular novel is how greed and the love of money can lead to destruction, selfishness. But in the end, after visits from the Christmas past, Christmas present, and Christmas future spirits from the novel, Ebenezer Scrooge learns to appreciate life. If we as human beings have an abundance of wealth, it should be shared with the less fortunate. The love of human beings far outweighs the gift of wealth. Dickens' humiliating experiences are not specifically indicated in this novel. However, his conflicting feelings for his father as a result of these experiences are responsible for the double personality of the novel's protagonist, Ebenezer Scrooge. In 1824, Dickens' father, John, was hauled off to prison at the Marshalsea, and Charles, 12 at the time, only 12, was forced to stay at inns nearby, pawn off his great book collection, and drop out of school, and take up employment at a blacking factory. Charles had a deep sense of etiquette and intellect, and was very uncomfortable in the factory atmosphere and the co-workers who worked directly with him. His co-workers referred to him as the young gentleman. Charles' father was released after 3 months in confinement. His father made him return to the factory instead of going back into school, which obviously was a mistake, and it only angered and humiliated Charles even further. Charles basically says his happy life went on to be nothing but anguish and pain. These disturbances cause many psychological issues and haunting memories, as Charles goes on. Charles both loved and despised his father. These psychological issues assisted in creating the two different personalities of Ebenezer Scrooge, a cold, stingy, greedy individual, and on the other personality, sociable generosity and goodwill toward all men was his outlook, an angel type of man. Another inspiration was early in his childhood that he observed the lives of men, women, and children in the most poverty-stricken areas of London and witnessed the social injustices they suffered. So basically, he went on after writing this novel, and he actually, years later, he took it to another level and actually was reading it live on stage, which definitely got a great following. And once he departed, of course, we also know quite a few people went on to create A Christmas Carol movie. I believe the most recent one that everybody has probably seen, the animated version of A Christmas Carol starring Jim Carrey, which is definitely something to see, but it's more a comedic look into the actual novel, which that's not the direction that Charles Dickens was really wanting you to understand. And what I would like you folks in the audience to get from this really is, let's enjoy ourselves as a family and have a Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, and not be all about the gifts and what we could and could not afford this year. Just the warm hearts, getting together, and loving each other. I leave you with that, and this is David Charles Dickens, signing off. And again, have a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. On behalf of East County Magazine.
This is Helen Ofield from the Lemon Grove Historical Society, bringing you the sounds of history. It's the holiday season here in Southern California, and memories of Christmas past keep bubbling up along with the champagne. Up and down the West Coast, even over the northern border into British Columbia, the weather tended to be kinder and gentler, just like now. The older we get, the more we think back to those childhood Christmases. So here we go, back to once upon a time. On the eve of St. Nicholas, I am inevitably reminded of those Christmases decades ago, when Victoria, British Columbia was filled with carolers, holly wreaths, punch bowls, and secrets. We children prayed for snow in that mild climate, pleading with the Almighty to at least send clouds and drizzle, the better to make the Christmas houses even cozier and merrier. Resolutely, we shut our eyes to the multiple Santa Clauses dotting the street corners. We knew that only one, the true bestower of rewards, because of course we were perfect children, and bestower of loot would crash about in the chimney, consume the brandy and fruitcake left for him, then depart with Donner and Blitzen, leaving a trail of marvelous, knobby packages in his wake. For my father, Christmas meant extra work at his dairy, which was also well-staffed with many Italian immigrants. He used to deliver milk on a wagon pulled by a brown horse aptly dubbed Brownie. My brother and I took turns on December weekends, aiding with the delivery of eggnog, whipping cream, butter, and ice cream. Everything was real then. Everything was fattening. It also felt so strange to rise before dawn, eat huge bowls of oatmeal, pack immense ham sandwiches, then drive away in the dark and silent dawn. When we sat on Brownie, a benumbed individual in a straw hat, whose leaden saunter belied, I was sure, a heart of fire, his sole reaction was a doleful gaze over one shoulder. Yet we felt daring and powerful to be seated so far from the ground, and our hearts leapt up when Brownie shifted position, or, as we later described it to school chums, leaped and galloped forward while we hung on for dear life. Along the milk route, mothers used to give us cookies and tell us we were responsible children. Their own children turned green with envy as we strode past, clinking bottles for effect, and intoning, "Here's your extra order, Mrs. Robinson." Father used to whisper the customers' names to us as we approached so we could give things a personal touch. But when we got to Con Maggiore's house, Father would break into the Toreador song from Carmen, giving it his best tenor tremolo. Con's bass would boom from the kitchen, and they'd finish the chorus together on the back stoop, waving eggnog aloft to the delight of the urchins, who instantly gathered. Every year at Christmas, the dairy company threw a huge party for the employees and their families. This bacchanal was always held in the Knights of Pythias Hall, which was full of huge, brass-studded leather chairs and crepe-papered tables loaded with edibles. We never ever saw any Pythian knights and kept wondering when we'd hear the clank of armor. We never dreamed that somebody's portly father, sitting next to us in the hall, paper plate on knee, was such a legendary creature. As we grew older, my sisters and I would entertain with song and dance, invariably noting brats that we were, that we compared very favorably to the other performers in the talent show. But I recall one disastrous number.
Mother dressed me in a baggy gown and stuffed it fore and aft with pillows, so I would resemble a prototype opera singer. Clutching a picture of an unshaven, cigar-chomping sergeant, I sang My Hero from The Chocolate Soldier in ringing falsetto tones to show I was an old-fashioned, whooping crane-type singer. But nobody in the audience knew what was so funny, and neither did I, so I exited to thundering silence. I was 13 and crushed. Various dairymen, who were good sports, took turns every Christmas being Santa Claus. One evening, Father told us he'd been chosen for the role. He loved this sort of thing. On the big day, Father's arrival from the North Pole was signaled by mad jingling of bells, and all the children at the party began shrieking with excitement. Throughout the gift-giving ceremony, he kept up a steady stream of jolly prattle as each child hurtled forward for a package. As we approached, there were elaborate winks from other parents as Father rumbled, "Now, who can this be?" Everybody got a mesh stocking filled with whistles and yo-yos. Boys received leather stamping sets or dump trucks. Girls got embroidery sets, wash me, spank me, change me dollies, or weaving sets, advising us to make a sampler, just like mother's, who had never made one in her life. But I dreaded the abruptness of ending it all the day after Christmas. The grand festival had arrived and departed in a trice, and all we could do was grow a bit older. It was all so funny and silly and amateur and affectionate. But it bred whimsy and fancy in our souls, that same fancy that prompts children to think a chair, a locomotive, an old curtain, a trailing court dress, or a man in a red flannel suit, the real Santa Claus. It is the part that is the essence of play. It is easily damaged, as all precious things are. Each Christmas, one hopes that the child in us will survive the commercial onslaught and retain not the material trappings, but the meaning of the rituals for everyone, no matter who, no matter where. For the Sounds of History, I'm Helen Ofield.
The County of San Diego and the U.S. Marine Corps are teaming up to bring smiles to children's faces this holiday season. You can help by donating a new, unwrapped toy to their annual Toys for Tots drive. Collection boxes are out through December 17th at 4 county airports, including Gillespie Field in El Cajon and the Ramona Airport here in East County. The toys that are donated are distributed each year to less fortunate children in our county communities. As they have done in previous years, Marines will hold a special collection in person and in full uniform from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. on Saturday, December 10th at the Ramona Airport. Donations can include new unwrapped toys, bikes, games, dolls, stuffed animals, or other items to delight youngsters in need. Pilots can also fly in their donations to the airports. No reindeer or sleigh necessary to brighten up a child's holiday season. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Fistier.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Liz Alper, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Pond 5. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.